Ends of the lands that we're meeting on, Cammeraygal people, my respects to the elders and their concern for this land over tens of thousands of years. So these talks happen every Friday night. Is anyone new to these events? Welcome. So my name is Nawishi, for those of you that know me, and please come and find me at any time if you have any questions. So essentially, there's a guided meditation for about 20 minutes, and then there's a tea break and a talk and time for questions at the end. Toilets are just around the corner past elevators. I might just do a few quick announcements. Our friends of the community, Tom and Lynn Halbert, are doing a suture print project for Bhante's translations of the Buddhist scriptures, essentially, the early Buddhist teachings. There's a set of 28 of them, which you can sponsor to be sent out to educational institutions and libraries and temples in Australia, or get a set for yourself. So there's a little flyer just on the table over there, so feel free to. There's a link for expression of interest, so they're just getting some interest for logistics to see how much they're going to print and what have you, I think. And if you want to volunteer as well, come find me. I can give you Lynn's address. If you're new, there's a little newbie's guide with some good tips. So have a look at that, and also just encourage everyone to take a flyer and hand it over to friends. I'll keep it brief. Just introduce the speaker, Bhante Sujato. He's been a Buddhist monastic for nearly 30 years. He's a senior teacher in the region. I think we're extremely lucky to have someone with his experience and abilities coming every Friday to talk to us all. He's done quite a few, he's published quite widely, he's done quite a few events and workshops and retreats and talks, lots of them on YouTube. He's also co-founded Sutta Central, so it's suttacentral.net if you're interested, which has the Buddhist teachings, the translations of the Buddhist teachings for free access. You can also download them or print them out. So he was the abbot of Santi Monastery for about 10 years. He trained in Thailand initially in the forest tradition. And just keep it at that. If anyone wants to get onto the mailing list, come and find me. I can add your details. Enjoy. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nawishi.
Do you want the fan?
Do I want the fan? I'm good. Does anybody else want the fan? How are we? Okay, well, look, let us know if we're getting too stuffy or whatever. How about online? How are we going online? Have we got sound? Do we have sound? Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. Do we need the fan online? good. All right. Oh, chanting sheets. Do we have chanting sheets? Anyone who needs chanting sheets, please. Okay, let us begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami.
Iti piso Bhagava Araham Samma Sambuddho.
Vijja Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu.
Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarathi.
Sattva Deva Manusanam Buddho Bhagavati.
Svakato Bhagavata Namo
Sandhitiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Hachatam Veditamo Vinyuhi.
Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Iyadidam chatari purisa yugani
anha purisa kundala.
Esa bhagavato savaka sangho.
Ahuneyo dakirneyo
Anjali karaniyo
anuttaram punyakesam lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. So, Venerable Bjorn, good to see you. We connected on briefly on the forum. Good to see you showing up. You're in France, is that right?
Hello, Bante. Hello, everyone. No, I'm outside of
Madrid. Sorry, I still can't hear you. I'm not sure if the volume's turned on at this end. Anyway, France? Yes? No?
Spain.
Okay.
Spain.
All right. So I'm going to say a few words about meditation, then we can do some practice together. Does that sound like a good idea? Yes. Anybody who's so peaceful that they don't even need to meditate. You know, the Buddha still meditated. Why would the Buddha meditate? If you do meditation in order to get enlightened, does that mean the Buddha wasn't enlightened? He had to keep on meditating? Like, why would he put himself through that grueling torture of meditation? Why would he force himself to endure pain and hardship of bad knees, sore backs, and all of those things? Why would he force himself to do this thing? Could it be that he wasn't forcing himself at all? Could it be that he actually enjoyed it? Could it be that he meditated because it was nice? Because he couldn't imagine anything better to do with his time? Could it be that even as the Buddha, this was the best thing for him to do, was to meditate, both because he loved to meditate and he enjoyed it, but also to set an example for future generations? Yeah. I suspect that may be the case. I suspect it may be. So when it comes our turn to meditate, surely we have even more reason to meditate than the Buddha did. We can enjoy our meditation. We can do it to set an example, but we also do it because we're suffering and because we are trapped in that mire of suffering and we want a way out. Yeah. How pervasive is suffering? How deep is it? How dark is it? How much does it get its tendrils into every facet of our life? Seriously, is there a single thing you can think of in your life that never brings any suffering along with it? And if you can think of something like that, I say to you, just you wait. And that is the nature of the world. It just is. And most of us, most of the time, we get used to it. We think, okay, that's how the world is. We'll just deal with that. We'll just try to do our best. And meditation can help with that. It can help us to grow those things that we love about the world, about our life, about our experience, and to leave behind those things that we dislike, the things that are causing us suffering and causing suffering for others as well. So meditation can help with those things, but at the end of the day, we are still here. Life still goes on, and the world still is full of all of its contradictions and its sorrows. So this is where we are in terms of our practice. Now, to meditate is to have a profound and quite radical confidence in one's own abilities to understand your own mind, to understand suffering, to understand why am I here, what am I doing. To meditate is a leap of faith. It is to say, inside myself, I can find the answers to these problems. I'm not going to find them in the library. I'm not going to find them on the internet. I'm not going to find them by some monk droning on yet again. This is not going to give us the answer. But maybe I can find the answer inside myself. Just maybe. And it is a leap of faith because to begin with, we don't really see that, right? We have this idea. We hope that it can be. We think it can be. But we don't really know. But each time we sit and each time we meditate, we learn a little bit about ourselves. Each time we meditate, we find out that, oh, there actually was this thing that was causing suffering. And I managed to let go of it. And then now it's not causing me suffering anymore. And we see those moments of stillness, those moments of letting go, those moments of renunciation. You can see them happening in your meditation, you can feel almost like a whirlpool in water that's spinning round, and then it ends and the water is still. There's like a movement or an energy which we're craving latches on to something. It latches onto an idea, latches onto a memory, latches onto a feeling. And that energy goes round and round and round that thing. And then we can say, oh, we won't. And it relaxes. And where before there was a whirlpool of spinning, now there is peace. We can see those moments in meditation. We can see them every time we meditate. When we reflect back, whenever I teach meditation, I always teach to reflect back at the end of the meditation. When we reflect back, we can remember that, oh, there was that moment. Somehow I let go. That's what letting go is. That's what letting go is. That's how we teach ourselves how to let go. I remember I had one student in Malaysia who had a lot of problems with anxiety and so on. And then she said she had like one teacher, I think it was a yoga teacher or something like that. And then she was always telling her, let's just relax. She's like, but how do I relax? What do you mean relax? What does it mean to relax? How do you feel to relax? She had no context to understand what relaxing meant. So instead, we can't like, there's no method that can teach us to do that. There's no kind of answer of how you're going to do that. So rather than doing that, we learn from our own experience because we learn from how our mind actually lets go. That's how you learn how to let go. That's how you learn how to relax, by reflecting back, realizing that's what was happening. And you learn to recognize the patterns. Okay, it's moving a little bit. And then there's a letting go. Yeah, there's a letting go. And through recognizing and understanding those patterns, then you train yourself little bit by little bit to understand that letting go is a state of nature. Holding on is a state which is deforming nature. The nature of the mind is to come to stillness. As long as we are not creating agitation, the mind will become still. Right? This is a fundamental lesson in meditation. As long as we are not creating agitation, the mind will become still, just like with water in a pond. As long as the wind is not blowing it, as long as it's not stirred up, the water will become still. This is the nature of the water, is to become still when the conditions are there for it to be still. So meditation, it leads us from a state of tension, a state of holding on, a state of deformation, and it leads us to a state of openness and relaxation and peace. Let's do some meditation now. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Letting that gentle feeling of the breath caress you. Letting it calm you. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And seeing in that breath a movement of light, an uplifting feeling of joy, and feeling that lightness and that buoyancy move through your whole body. Easing the tensions, lightening the dark places, Now coming near to the end of the meditation, I want you to reflect back over the practice we've done together. Inquiring into cause and effect, understanding what was that like? How did my mind change? What were those moments of letting go? Was there a time that I felt like my body became lighter? Was there a time I felt like the energies were coming into balance? What's it like now? Inside my body, inside my mind, inside my heart. What is it like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. All right, so let's have a bit of a break. Grab a cup of tea and then come back for some Dhamma talk. Okay. So Bjorn saying that he's from Spain. I'm not sure if the it's not my laptop, so I'm not sure if the speakers are working on here. So Marianne said blah 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 dear Bhante. Oh, I shouldn't say that, it's very disrespectful. I'm sorry, Marianne. Marianne said, dear Bhante, happy to see you and listen to your teaching. Well, I'm very happy to be able to give the teaching. When you say the nature of the mind is to be peaceful, does it mean that one is skillful enough, one can stay with that peaceful nature of the mind always? Yes, well, that isn't exactly what I said. You see? See, I'm already being misinterpreted. Doesn't take long. I said the nature of the mind is to become peaceful. Yeah, if the conditions are there, the mind will become peaceful. If the conditions are not there, the mind will become agitated. So, yes. Not sure if that answers your question, but at least, anyway, you can ask another question if you want to. So anyway, hi. I just want to say a quick hi to folks online. Tessa, how's it going? Ryan and Casey, how you going? Megan. Margaret, Mike, Michelle, Dhira Yupa. The youthful sage. And Esther, wonderful to see you as always. And all of our other friends who are joining us, Ahmed, Santi community, and all our other friends joining us from all over the place. So how are we all going today?
Peaceful.
Peaceful. Really? Nice. Nice. Excellent. Veronica, how's the Navy going? Still running? Saved any souls lately? Have you saved any souls lately? That's not my job. There's no soul. Lessons in Buddhist theology from Sinsin. Okay, very good. I'm not taking questions just now. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Barbara, how's death going? How's dying going?
Yeah.
Dying's okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Barbara looks after the dying.
Yeah, the lady I would say.
Yeah.
Wednesday night.
Ah, really?
Nine.
Oh, my goodness.
I saw her on Tuesday. Yeah.
Okay.
She was unconscious. conscious. Yeah, but I've just, I think the, I've been doing these, the chant that we do here, and she just loved it. Yeah, so she was from,
oh, that's so
she
nice.
Was from Thailand, so yeah,
it's amazing.
A real blessing for me to be able to sort of accompany her. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
She's very lucky to have someone like you looking after her.
I was lucky to like be able to sort of be with her. She taught me a lot. Yeah.
I saw in the paper that apparently Nicole Kidman is wanting to do a new career as a death doula. Yes. I was thinking, as a death doula, help people through the process of dying. And it's kind of interesting, but I feel like there's a lot of people whose last words are going to be, hang on, is that Nicole Kidman? Anyway. Anyway, I've been thinking a little bit about that, and there's kind of a very noble task of like preparing people for dying. Like in a way, we can think of like the Dharma practice or the Buddhist practice as being a preparation for dying or reconciling with the reality of impermanence. I was recently reading about a philosopher who had a rather different take on dying, and I thought I might just share a few reflections. So in Russia, in the 19th century, there was a librarian who it was said that when people would go into the library that they would be struck by the kindness of his face, and people would say that they'd never seen anything like that before. There's something about him that moved people. When homeless people or impoverished people came into the library, then he would just let them be. He wouldn't disturb them or anything. He'd let them go to have a nice sleep. And he lived a very simple life. He only earned a small stipend from his library work, but he gave most of it away. He died in a house for the poor. And for somebody living such a very simple life, he also was said to be very brilliant and have an incredible knowledge and inquiring mind. In fact, it was said that he there was not a book on his shelves that he hadn't read, and that when specialists came to do research in the library, that he would very often bring them books on their own speciality that they'd never even heard of. It's very handy in the days before Google. So he ran a salon or like a discussion circle there, and they called him the Socrates of Moscow. And people would come and they'd have like discussions and so on. And no matter what no matter what the content of his philosophy or his ideas, everybody agrees that he was a man of incredibly kind of noble and humble nature whose thought and philosophy was at the one hand very broad, but at the other hand extremely focused. He would always talk about what he called the common task of humanity. And he believed that we could be all and should be all drawn together by a common task. When I read this phrase, I've not encountered this phrase before. I thought it was kind of an interesting idea, because like sometimes when we talk about things, we talk about destiny, right? So what is human destiny? We all share blah, 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 destiny. But a destiny is just something that you have, right? Destiny is not something that you earn or fate or something like that, or else we're drawn together because we have the same nature, right? Or we're all the same because we have the same nature or something like this. But this is a way of phrasing unity, not in terms of what you are or what you have, but in terms of what you do. and in particular in terms of a moral duty, a common task and a common goal, which is shared. I thought there was something quite beautiful about that, something which is quite inspiring, and something which, I don't know, I personally, I kind of feel is lacking. Like, I feel that we, like, as a people and as a civilization, sometimes we kind of lost that sense of, like, having a purpose, that we're actually doing things, working together to achieve something as a purpose. It's very easy to lose that, become very short-sighted. So there was something about this guy who was kind of interesting and inspiring, and just, you know, I'm very far from the first person to notice these qualities. He was there were many of the most famous figures of Russia at the time were great fans of his. Leo Tolstoy was one of his devotees. Fyodor Dostoevsky said he agrees with him in everything. And so he was kind of renowned and revered, almost as a quasi-mystical figure. He wasn't an ordained figure or a specifically religious figure, but he was a very devoted Russian Orthodox. So his life, and he was very ascetic in his life. He was celibate. He lived a life of simplicity, and everything about him was devoted to this common task of humanity, which he brought into everything, which was illuminated all of his understanding and all of his passions. Now, in many ways, he has been very influential. In fact, he's probably the most influential philosopher, perhaps difficult to say these things, but perhaps the most influential philosopher of modern times. But none of us have really heard of him. His name's Nikolai Fyodorov. You've heard of him?
I have. Yeah, you've heard of him. Much about him.
Yeah, I know he was influential in the theosophical circles to some degree, yeah. And he founded a school of philosophy called the Russian Cosmists. Those of you who may have heard of Teskriel, anyone heard of Teskriel? I gave a talk on Teskriel a little while ago, transhumanism, extropism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, effective accelerationism, and long-termism. Cosmism is the C in Teskriel, okay? I gave a long talk about Teskriel a couple of years ago. Teskriel is a cluster of philosophies that has been very influential in shaping Silicon Valley and the modern sort of tech communities. And the Russian cosmists were the original, or perhaps some of the oldest people who are enunciating a lot of these kinds of ideas. And all goes back to Nikolai Fyodorov. Now, many of the ideas that he spoke about are things that we can recognize are very similar to what today we would think of as technological libertarianism, these kind of things. For example, he opposed copyright, right? At that time, 19th century, they were introducing the notion of copyright. Originally began with Charles Dickens and authors in England whose works were being reprinted in America, and they made a lot of money from it, but they weren't getting any money from it. So they wanted to have these arrangements where they would get money for their work. Fair enough, right? Who wants to let Americans get the money for your work? Come on. So this is where the idea of copyright originally came from. But Fyodorov was completely opposed to it. He believed that information wanted to be free, and he believed that it should not be constrained in any way. This is why he worked in libraries his whole life. In fact, he refused to let any of his work be published during his lifetime. And after his life, when it was published, the publisher put on a thing saying this is like for free distribution, and they wouldn't take any money for it. So he had that idea. It's a very noble ideal of the spreading of information. He was a proponent of interlibrary loans, right? Now today we take that for granted. It's just something that happened. But in those days, there was a new idea, right? And if you didn't have that book in your local library, you couldn't read that book. That's just how it was. And so the ability to learn then became very dominated by the few institutions that had monopoly over the books. So he wanted to open that up. He was always looking for ways to bring people together through his common task. For example, he believed that there was an origin of humanity in, I think, Central Asia or something, somewhere, and he wanted to go and do an archaeological dig and to see if they could find any evidence for that. And so he proposed that the British and the Russians should work together to go and do that. And, of course, the British and Russians were enemies at the time. So this is kind of a radical suggestion, yeah? But that's, I think, emblematic of the way that he thought, right? So, again, bringing people together not by making some fine words that we should all get along, but by a common task that we're going to work together to achieve something that is going to reveal the fact that we have never really been separate. He had what seems to be like almost like a repulsion or a horror at unkindness and at the lack of love in the world. He saw the suffering of the world as a violation of nature. He believed that God created the world to be good and that the way of nature should be happiness and should be kindness and should be love, and yet we had all fallen from that. And so this idea of like the fall and sin and so on, which of course is very fundamental in Christian theology. So again, his common task was to rectify all of this. He was a great believer in reason. And here we have the R of the test reel coming into play as well, the rationalism. So he believed that we could rationally reflect about our situation, about our life, about the world, and we could use our will to make things better. We could plan to make things better. For example, by guaranteeing that crops would grow. Okay? We should no longer be subject to the whims of nature of when the rain would fall. So, for example, in those days, they were starting to do some experiments with things like seeding clouds and so on and trying to figure out today what we would think of as geoengineering. And he was a big fan of this. He said we should rectify this. People would, and then when Christians would criticize it and say, but it's against the will of God, he'd say, no. The will of God is that we should all flourish. And these things arise because there's something that's gone wrong with nature. And this is an interesting idea, which actually connects with Buddhist ideas in the same sphere. So from a Buddhist point of view, it has long been held that when the king is unrighteous, the rains will not fall and the crops will not grow. And when Buddhists, traditional Buddhists, recite their verses, Raja Dhammiko, may the king be righteous, may the rains fall in time, and this is what is felt to be the normal way that things will happen. If we run and organize ourselves properly, the rains will fall in season. Now, if we were writing in the 19th century, you'd probably think, well, that's a superstition. How can it be that the choices of kings is going to stop the rain from falling? Now, here we are, 2026, and that's what we see literally happening all around. Because of unjust, corrupt leaders, then the rains don't fall in season or they fall too much and whatever. So he believes, Fyodorov believes that we can take control of that. So we can master nature. Yeah? We can master nature. Now, at that time, there was already in Russia a great concern about ecological destruction. I remember reading Dostoevsky years ago about how the forests of Russia were all disappearing. We tend to think of these things as being a modern thing, but they've been going on for a long time. So Fyodorov believed that we can take control of nature and design things in a way that is going to be for the flourishing of humanity. I think time has shown that it's not that simple. I mean, in many ways, we've done that, right? In many ways, we've applied our intelligence and our science and our engineering and our chemistry and so on to be able to do just that and produce food reliably and so on. But there's also a cost, because the reality is nature is complex and delicate, and we don't really understand what all of the implications are of what we're doing. But this was his perspective. We bring our will, our reason, and our dominion to be able to shape nature, not by making it unnatural, but by rectifying the already distorted and corrupted state of nature. Yeah. Okay. Fyodorov disliked Buddhism. All you Buddhists just sit around and meditate, navel gaze, and then just accept whatever's happening and don't bloody care about anything like that, okay? Rightly or wrongly, that's what he thought. Didn't like Hinduism because you're just dissolving back into like a cosmic oneness or something like that, and that's not the plan. He didn't like individualism, right? He didn't like individualism. Selfish, narcissistic, infantile. What he did like was ancestors and family. And a lot of what he taught was about how we build up relationships through kin. Okay? And that one of the fundamental differences between a family and like an artificial group, like let's say an office, right, or a corporation, when somebody leaves work, they can be replaced. If somebody's working in a factory, they leave, they can be replaced, but your father can't be replaced. Your sister can't be replaced. Your daughter can't be replaced. Everybody in the family constellation is unique and irreplaceable. And so through those networks of family constellations, he believed that humanity had something which is greater than itself or greater than just an individual. And so he believed that we cannot save one without saving everyone. All right? We cannot save one without saving everyone. So in some ways, I think his ideas were very influential on modern test wheel philosophies and so on. But in other ways, I think it's completely opposed. I think he would be horrified at modern capitalism. I'm sure he would be horrified. He'd be horrified at the greed. He'd be horrified at the reductionism of it. But he believed that we could somehow save ourselves through saving everybody else. And further, but this is where his philosophy starts to get interesting, because he didn't just believe that the corruption of the world was evident in people's unkindness and in the erratic rainfall. He believed that the corruption of the world was evident through death, that God's role was to bring life and that death was the corruption of life. I mean, that's essentially straight out of Genesis, right? They're just, here we are, living in the Garden of Eden, everything's great, sin enters the world, and then we're kicked out, and then we have to experience birth, aging, and death. I did a thing on dependent origination, when was that, last year? And I did one of the talks was on how the teachings of dependent origination parallel the myth of Genesis and the origin myth of Genesis, point by point. So anyway, go and have a listen to that if you're interested. So he believed that death was a violation of nature. Death was not acceptable. It was not okay. So we have to become immortal. So in this way, he was also prefiguring the transhumanism, which is the T part of test creel, right? That we can somehow take control of our destinies, change who we are at a fundamental level so that we can live forever. But we can't do that. Modern transhumanists do that on the individual level, or they want to do that. I'm going to live forever. Yeah? Whereas he believed that it's only possible if everybody was to live forever. Okay? It's not possible for one person to live forever, but everyone has to live forever. But when he said everyone, he really meant everyone, not just the people who are alive right now. but all of your ancestors as well. So he believed that the real meaning of his common task was the resurrection of the dead, that we should bring to life all of our ancestors. And since, I guess, Earth is not going to be big enough, but he was also a cosmist. So he also believed that we should settle the galaxy and settle all the stars with all of those humans. So that, and the fact, I can imagine you're probably feeling a little bit skeptical about that now. I'm trying to urge you to have an empathetic response to this. You think about it. He would say that like, how can you say that you love your parents if when they die you just bury them and then just let them go? If you truly love them, you can only love them by being with them. And so he would say that the rejection of death is the true manifestation of love, and that the acceptance of death is narcissistic, because it's just I matter and all of my ancestors and so on, they don't matter, right? I mean, I'll go and put a flower on their grave or something like that. I'll pretend that I kind of love them, but really I only really care about myself. Yeah? He thought this was childish and a very limited way of thinking. So we're going to, so the Russian cosmists were not just mystics, but they're also quite practical. So he had these ideas about how you're actually going to achieve this. So essentially, he believed that in any person would contain like the full, like physical self from the both mother and father. So from one person, like today we would call it like cloning. Like you could clone the bodies of the mother and father. And once a mother and father are there, then you could clone their mother and father and so on and so forth. And so you could actually, he was dead serious about it, okay? And of course, from a Christian point of view, well, it is kind of a religion about resurrection, right? And there is a precedent for that idea that you bring people back from the dead in their physical form. Yeah? These days we tend to think of Christianity as believing in like an immortal soul, that you die and your soul will go to heaven and so on. But there is actually a strong strand within Christianity that speaks of the resurrection of the body. And without kind of going too much into that, but his idea again is not, this is not, Fyodorov's idea is obviously is not normal Christianity. Right? Sure. But it's also not that unjustifiable compared to what we see in the Bible or whatever. Okay, so this is the idea. We're going to bring everybody back together. We can't be ourselves. We can't be good. We can't love unless we bring everyone back together. This is the common task of humanity. And this is what he believed is what we need to learn in order to have a future for humanity. All right? So this is my understanding of Fyodorov's ideas. And I don't know about you, but I don't know, when I started reading about these things, I found it kind of strangely, like on the one hand kind of absurd, but on the other hand kind of strangely moving. Like to me that there's a sincerity in what he was saying, where he like single-mindedly followed through his philosophy and his theology to unafraid of what the consequences might be. But I also think that time has not been kind to those ideas, and time has not been kind to the idea that we should exert dominion over nature. And that idea, it strikes me as being a very Christian idea, that somehow we have the responsibility of reshaping nature. And one of the things that really struck me was about how these Christian ideas, ultimately Christian ideas, also underlie the Tescreel philosophies. So how, and these days, as some of you may be aware, but there's been a sharp turn back to Christianity among the tech bros, and to very very hyper-conservative forms of Christianity. And we've seen in the last week, you've seen spats between the Trump administration and the Pope. Very entertaining, if not particularly edifying. But, of course, what the Pope is saying is, you know, the world is being run by tyrants and war is bad and peace is good. This is kind of mainstream, straight out of the Gospels Christianity, according to what most people think Christianity is. But there is something in these very extremist ideas which somehow is appealing to people. When Gebru and Torres did their original work on the Thesauri of philosophies, one of the things they focused on was that the hidden unifying philosophy of all of those was eugenics. It's the idea that to make humanity better, we have to breed good genes and not breed bad genes. Okay, so eugenics, again, a long topic, but has a rather unedifying history in 20th century. And, of course, the German final solution was the annihilation of the Jews was a purely eugenicist project. So I'm not accusing Fyodorov of being eugenicist at all. As far as I know, he wanted all of humanity to be included in his project. I'm not entirely sure about that detail, but as far as I know, he was. But it strikes me that the counterpart of the eugenicist project is the immortality project. All of these people have to die so that we can live forever. No? And again, that's not what Fyodorov believed. He believed that we can only achieve immortality if everyone achieves immortality. Now, all of these ideas come within the philosophy or the philosophical idea that the Buddha called eternalism or sasatavada. And we find this is taught very often in the suttas. Brahmajala Sutta gives like a whole different range of different sasatavada. So all of the sasatavada, all of those people taught that somehow we're going to live forever. Right? It's a longing for immortality in all kinds of different ways. And there are many, sometimes it's like the individual soul will live forever. Sometimes it is that the veil that hides me from the immortal deity of the universe will fall away. Or in these kinds of forms, it's that we can change our physical being. We can evolve our organs and our bodies so that we can live forever in a physical form. When Fyodorov was talking about resurrecting the ancestors, there's a slight problem. Like if you clone your mum and dad, great. Hi, how's it going, mum and dad? But it's just a clone, right? It's not actually them. So then there's another whole thing that he had about how do you actually capture their minds or their souls and how do we reconstitute these. See, he believed that we would be able to solve these problems. Such was his faith in human reason and human potential, that he believed that we'd not just resurrect their bodies, we would resurrect them body, mind, and soul. Yeah. And we would live forever. So I was sort of reflecting about this from a Buddhist point of view and thinking, like, for all of that sincerity, it seems that, like, it's a philosophy which starts out with kindness and starts out with love and starts out with concern and care for all of humanity, starts out with care for the world, for the ecology, and ends up in a place of madness. I thought that was really interesting. I wondered if you would start from a similar place, but if we understand it from a Buddhist point of view, from the point of view of impermanence, and if from the point of view of rather than striving for immortality, perhaps our common task is the acceptance of our mortality. Perhaps it is up to us to not try in all of these different ways to create immortality. I mean, shall we list them, you know? Social media, immortality project, right? AI, immortality project. Like cosmetic surgery, immortality project, right? all of these cryogenics immortality project, settling the universe immortality project, cloning oneself immortality project. And so much of what we're doing today, it comes from an inability to accept the reality of death. And if we are, rather than coming from an attitude of will and dominion, but coming from an attitude of acceptance and humility, to realize that the way of nature has a wisdom in itself that surpasses our human understanding, that we cannot know why that plant grows in that particular place. We can know some things about it, but we can never really understand everything there is about that. And there is a wisdom in that smallest act of nature that surpasses our own understanding. And so our human role, rather than to dominate nature according to our will, but our human role should be to accept the reality of nature and to ask ourselves, how can we embody and fulfill and live our lives so as to lead to an abundance and a fullness of nature. That is to say, to live in line with nature rather than live by making nature in line with us. Yeah. So perhaps our common task is to ask ourselves, here we are in this great age, 2026, the peak of human civilization. How do I know it's the peak of human civilization? Because of TikTok. I don't know, whatever. Maybe we passed the peak some time ago. I don't know, whatever. Here we are, and we have so much capabilities. Many of the things that they were dreaming of, the Russian cosmonauts dreamt of, are now realities. One of Fyodorov's students was another one of the Russian cosmonauts. His name was Shirovsky. I have to pardon my Russian. Sorry?
Not Sikorsky, no.
Pardon my Russian pronunciation, which I learned from reading Dostoevsky and trying to pronounce the names with my girlfriend, and that never went particularly well. But anyway, he was a student of Fyodorov, and he went on to, in 1903, publish the first paper describing what today we would understand as a space-faring rocket. Kind of incredible. He was another ascetic. He was a recluse living in a hut in the forest somewhere in Russia. And he wrote all of these diagrams, a three-stage rocket. He worked out all the math. This was fueled by hydrogen and oxygen. It's literally the same as what we're flying into space today. Three stages. Two stages fueled by hydrogen and oxygen. The top stage is where the astronauts go. He designed the airlocks, designed all of these systems, and published it in the paper. And then that was one of the inspirations for Wernher von Braun, and then the V2 program, and then for the modern space programs. So again, these people are much more, even though they've disappeared, but actually very influential. And so many of the things that they were just dreaming of in those days. But they believed that it was practical. They would believe that they would be able to achieve it. Many of those things we have achieved, but wrongly, everything's got twisted along the way because we haven't surmounted that human nature of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we have this power, but we don't know how to use it. We have this power. We have this capacity to do so many things, and we do it unwisely, because we're still driven by greed, hate, and delusion. And so perhaps what I'm suggesting is that rather than seeing our future as being greater dominion over nature, greater ability to shape nature to our will, what if we were to see it as being a greater ability for us to be understand our place within the greater scheme of nature. And that our consciousness, so in a way we are nature becoming aware of itself. We are, our ability to reflect on nature doesn't make us separate from and giving us command over nature, but our common task, our duty, our responsibility is to be part of that flourishing of nature. And it seems to me that everything that we have done with our incredible technology has been the opposite. It has been extraction, it has been destruction, it has been poison, and it's been death. And we have killed nature to a degree that it's honestly unfathomable what we have lost. It's literally none of us can even vaguely begin to grasp the scope of what we have done. 3% of mammals on planet Earth are wild. 97% are humans and things that humans eat. The scope of what we have done to nature is unbelievable. We need to change, and we need to set our course aright. So from the Buddhist point of view, all of that is a distortion of the mind created by that immortality project, created by the idea that somehow in this world of change and impermanence, we cannot change. We can become eternal. We can dominate not just our planet, but the entire cosmos. Yeah. So these are some thoughts for you on Nikolai Fyodorov and his philosophy of the common task of humanity, and some maybe Buddhist ways of thinking about it. So Tim has commented, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, is that right? I think that's probably right, Tsiolkovsky. Again, apologies if there's any Russians present for my pronunciation. Or, yeah. Anyway, any questions? Venerable Tenzin.
Thought and a question. Would you think that there might be some fruitful avenues for inquiry looking at how actually in the Christian, like in the Gnostic or mystical tradition, they really cautioned against interpreting Genesis literally and saw it more as a metaphor right. for awakening of consciousness
no.
and that resurrection of Christ is something that happens in the Christian, not in the tomb itself, but something that's like awakening of consciousness.
Sure.
Is that something that you see as like a way out of this sort of almost like Christian clothing on this?
Right. Right. So yeah. So Venerable Tenzin is asking about like specifically Gnostic interpretations of Christianity. So yes, sure. Of course, there are much healthier. I would say, and more interesting, I don't want to say more interesting, but more, reasonable or less harmful interpretations of things. So, yeah, and obviously, you know, what Fyodorov represents a highly unique interpretation of Christianity. I don't believe any Christians I've ever met have believed in the resurrection of literal zombies. But it is interesting. Like it's interesting that it can be drawn on in these different ways, right? To create these different perspectives. Yeah. So I was going to make another point before about the what's with the Gnostics, Fyodorov,
Genesis resurrection.
It's gone. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Yeah, Sumana. Okay. Sorry, that the noble Sangha is our ancestors. You mean like? Okay. All right. So we still inherit those ideas. Yeah. Right. So that would be mimetic inheritance rather than genetic inheritance. Well, for him, it was biological, right? He wasn't necessarily thinking. I mean, genetics was just emerging at that time, right? I mean, he did frame this in terms of evolution, like he believed that this was the evolution. So he knew about Darwin and evolution and so on. But genetics was still just coming up. But yeah, you're talking about mimetic, right? So it's the ideas which are transmitted. Yeah.
Okay, I was recently in my
personal
spirit.
Yeah.
I wonder.
Okay.
My great-grandma,
what kind of
person they are.
Right.
So I asked my mom.
Right.
And then I
figured
out they have the same common trait.
Okay.
So it's come to my generation.
Right.
They're all very boss lady.
They're all very boss lady.
Okay,
so how many people here know Sumana and immediately think boss lady? Okay. Why not? Okay. 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 Right. Right. Sure. So yes, so that's right. So there's still like character and there's still tradition. So Fyodorov was very much a fan of tradition. Like, yes, you can see like almost to that extreme degree, like he followed these ideas to their logical conclusion, right? And but he would probably, I'm guessing he would probably see that what you're saying now as being narcissistic, that to think that we're somehow better than our ancestors. But anyway, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I said that he would say that. That's quoting my supposition. Okay. But anyway, yeah. But that does bring up a good point, right? Because this is another thing where I think that there's this obsession with like a biological or physical transmission. Like this is the essence of eugenics, right? So eugenics is roundly rejected by geneticists, right? You can't make humanity better by breeding better humans, because the notion of what a better human is isn't determined by genes, right? It's not like racehorses. A better racehorse is one who runs around the track faster, and so you can measure that and you can breed for a better racehorse, but you can't breed for a better human because it's complicated and it's not determined by genetics. But so there's an interaction of genetics with that, like the ideas, the character, the conditioning, and all of those kinds of things, which are also part of that conditioning. So this is again, I think, one of the flip sides of Fyodorov's idea, which on the one hand I think is quite beautiful, to unify humanity in a common task. And like I think that, you know, if you think of things like, let's say, the space race. This is one of the closest things to that we have, right? Everybody thinks, oh, we're going to go to space. It's great. It's really exciting. It's really wonderful. And you're actually bringing humanity together. It's certainly used in that way. But at the same time, I mean, I kind of think that he probably meant that everyone was going to have to become a Christian, right? I don't think you could be part of that common task unless you're a Christian. So there's a certain, once you say that humanity has a common task, there's a certain totalitarianism to that as well. He's the narcissistic one, says Sumana. You tell him, okay? I can hear your grandmother in there. Huh? Okay, very good. Okay, very good, excellent. So we might just take a couple of the questions from online. Ahmed draws the parallel with the open knowledge with like free software philosophy, exactly. And I kind of wonder whether those early sort of libertarian, cyber-libertarian ideas were influenced by the Russian cosmos. I think they were. I'm not sure how much they were aware of it. Ryan and Casey say, living in accordance with nature, I wonder how your ideas and this aligns with Diogenes and ancient cynicism. I'd appreciate your views on this. Well, I'd unlike Nikolai Fyodorov, I haven't read all of the books in the library, and I'm not enough of an expert to be able to say on those off the top of my head. But yeah, sorry about that. Maybe in the future I'll do one on those guys. Sorry about that. All right. So, okay. So it looks like that's it. Oh, Nilushi, go on. One more question. Go on.
I just wonder, so how do we relate to our mortality? I think in the scriptures there was something about some people who lived tens of thousands of years ago. I think there was a story about someone saying, there was some teacher saying that we have very short lives.
Right, yeah.
Oh, that they actually
live
for like 80,000 years.
Right,
something.
Right.
So is there, I guess, is a part of us that, if we've had the means, maybe we want to live longer, but is the whole purpose just to completely accept, falling apart, degrading, dying?
Yeah. To accept, yeah. Right, and even if you could live, I mean, like we talk about immortality, but I mean, are you going to survive the heat death of the universe? I mean, in the scale of eternity, the lifespan of the universe is not even a blip. It's like literally not even measurable compared to eternity. And so once we start to think through these ideas, then they rapidly become incoherent. But yes, the notion of humanity is to become, the task of the Dhamma is to accept those things and to understand that even if we were to extend our lives, we live for 200 years or 500 years or 1,000 years, I mean, what actually happens? I mean, it seems weird that you'd want to do that. Like you live, what are you going to do? So you're going to live for like, I don't know, are you going to be like stuck in your 30s for that time? Like, how does actually human growth work? Because human mind grows and evolves and changes over life. So what are you going to be? Are you going to like stay the same? What age are you going to be in when you get as you're getting older, or are you just going to continue to age? There's a Greek myth about that he wished never to die. Unfortunately, he didn't wish to not grow old. look, I'm going to have to call it right now because we're going to have to finish up. We've got a couple of things to mention, and thanks to everyone for contributing. But we have to also get out of here because of compassion for our lovely staff here at the centre. So just briefly to wrap up, we will be back here again next week, I think, and every Friday and every Tuesday at the 5 Library, Parramatta Square, 5 Parramatta Square at 6 p.m. And over the next month or 6 weeks or so, I'm going to be away for some periods. I'll be teaching retreat out past Broken Hill. So anybody who wants to come for that retreat who hasn't booked already, I'm sorry. Look, you can try booking because people usually cancel at the last minute, right? So it doesn't hurt to try if you want to come, but that is booked. And I'm also going to Indonesia for a little while and so on. So during the time that I'm away, then the sessions will continue. And I think the Venerables from Santi are going to come and uplift these sessions, okay? They're going to talk. They're going to be. It's going to be awesome. Yeah. So, thank you so very much to the Venerables for that. And Venerable Tenzin has a retreat tomorrow. They've come up very fast. Come.
So you can say hello to the people online.
Okay.
Thank you for the reminder, Nilushi, and for the space to just share very briefly that at Rhonda Place tomorrow from 9 p.m. till, 9 a.m. till, thank you, 9 a.m. till 4 p.m., is that right? 4:30? Okay. By committee. We're working out the schedule right now. We're going to have a number two of a series that was long ago promised, just moving through the four establishments of mindfulness. And this next one brings us to Vedana. And I'm looking forward to kind of exploring ways to practice with pleasant and also unpleasant feeling arising in the body and the mind. And we'll have plenty of time for practice. This is kind of an emphasis on practicum. So time to sit, time to ask questions, time to share a meal together and enjoy beautiful Rhonda Place in Concord. So yeah, 9 till 4:30 tomorrow. And we do need to register, yeah? So yeah. To be aware of numbers. And maybe it's relevant also to say that there is not a hybrid option despite what it says online. There is not a hybrid option.
It's a great retreat last time, so.
Thank you.
Also, I think Vedana Temple is joining Professor Jadhav for putting that arms around on Sunday.
Yes. So thanks very much, Venerable. So Pindabhata on Sunday at Burwood. Venerable Tenzin will be there. Venerable Prasanna. And the Sutta study in the afternoon at Rhonda Place at Sunday afternoon. So a bit of a busy weekend. Okay, I think that's it for now. Stay peaceful, everybody. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you, Monte, for a wonderful session today.
Thank you.
I was battling my ego today because I know Pani is always eager to ask questions. And I know I have a tendency to interrupt you, but I'm trying to
well,
control myself.
Good, excellent. Well, I'm glad. Thank you.
I know I have all this, but I'm trying to restrain myself. I know that I should not be closing my ego for everyone to show my intellect.